This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Staff writer Dexter Filkins has covered the war in Afghanistan for a very long time, first when he was a reporter for The New York Times, and then more recently for The New Yorker. His 2008 bestseller carried the resonant title, The Forever War. And now with the American withdrawal and the return to power of the Taliban, the Forever War seems to be coming to a chaotic and ominous end. I spoke with Dexter Filkins last week. Now, Dexter, we are watching the Taliban retake complete control of Afghanistan after 20 years of American presence and occupation. As someone who started reporting on this country late in the 1990s, and you were there even before, I know, how did this happen?
Wow. I have to say, I never quite imagined it, that the day would actually come. I always thought they'd kick the can down the road, you know, another decade. I think fundamentally, from the very beginning, there were two contradictions, fatal contradictions in the American project. And I think one was we made friends. Our chief friends were the warlords, and they set up the government. It was kind of a government sanctified by elections, but basically it became a criminal state that preyed on the Afghans and stole the American money and came to be really the greatest driver of Taliban recruitment. I think the other fatal contradiction is Pakistan. It was, you know, supposed to be our friend and ally. That's the country through which we sent the bulk of our supplies. We paid dearly for that privilege. But at the same time, Pakistan harbored the leadership. They knew where they were at all times. They allowed training camps. They allowed the Taliban to plan attacks. The Taliban basically had a sanctuary. And so it's hard to win a war when your enemy can just run across the border and hide. And I think those were the two things that were too big for the United States and the United States-backed government there to really to kind of overcome.
There's a number of people at The New Yorker, like at any media organization, who have relationships, close relationships, built over the years with translators, drivers, fixers, their families. They seem to have been abandoned. I'd love to know, as you're looking at the images of chaos and worse in Kabul this week and all over the country, and as the government collapsed, people swarming the airports desperate to escape, how you feel emotionally and what your concerns are.
Hey, it's just wrenching. It's horrible. I do. I know so many Afghans, and most of them I know through working with them, and most of them are still there. And I've been getting emails and phone calls from them all day long, every day for the past week.
What are they saying?
Help me. Get me out. What can I do? Some of them are women, and we're trying. It is indeed chaos there. And so there is allegedly a formal structure that the U.S. government set up,
a special immigrant visa program.
But I don't know anybody that got out. I don't know anyone. And, you know, the White House claims that there's a couple of thousand Afghans that they've pulled out, but I don't know who they are. And it doesn't, if it's only 2,000, it doesn't begin to touch the number of Afghans who risk their lives for the United States and who are still there.
How in the hell could that not have been anticipated? How is it possible that any government of any good sense, putting aside so many other issues, could not have begun this process in earnest and with real rigor and effort months ago to get these people out on transport planes? This particular aspect seems all on the Biden administration, no?
I absolutely agree. I think it's criminal. I think it's inexcusable. These are very intelligent people in the White House. I can only conclude that they knew, that they did the math, they knew what was going to happen, and they had to make a decision. Do we get these people out? And if we get them out, how long is it going to take? And how much is it going to cost? And how many troops are we going to have to use? And et cetera, et cetera. And how much further do we have to push the deadline down the road? And they concluded it wasn't worth it. I mean, I can't imagine otherwise. It's not that hard to figure out everybody who has spent any time.
What does that mean? It's not worth it. It's not worth it to whom?
It's inexcusable. That these are people who they believe what we believe. They are our friends in every sense of the word, and they want what we want, and they want that for their country, and they fought for us, and they risked their lives, and many of them died for us, and we have left thousands of them behind. They are still there.
The Taliban has issued statements here and there in the early days of the takeover of the country, or the repossession of the country after 20 years, making noises about different policy toward women, different policy toward school kids, even the media. How different is the Taliban now than it was 20 years ago when we were seeing executions in football stadiums and all kinds of brutality?
I spent a lot of time with the current Taliban leadership in Doha during the peace talks, and they look, they act, they speak. Well, they speak a little bit differently, but they're the same guys, and there just isn't a lot of evidence that they've changed their stripes. To me, this is the greatest tragedy of all. You know, the United States failed in so many realms in that country and in so many of its objectives, but the one area that it really succeeded was in liberating women and in educating girls. And I think in some ways that might be hopeful, because, I mean, if they stand back and say, what are we going to do? Are we going to, like, put them all back in their houses again? I can't. If they do that, it will be a terrible, terrible scene. But it's hard to imagine. And so if the Taliban are practical people at all, then they're going to have to set their ideology aside for a bit.
How would it be in the interest of the Taliban to behave more, to behave differently, to be more pacific, to be more welcoming of women in society and all the rest? Would it be to impress certain neighbors?
What the Taliban say, you know, what they told me in Doha, in the Ritz-Carlton, we learned our lesson. And the lesson was, the last time around when we governed the country, we had no friends. We were recognized diplomatically by only three countries in the world. We got no foreign aid. Our country was in ruins. The economy was dead in the water. We had nothing. So we were doomed to fail. We don't want to repeat that experience. We need friends. We need the West to be engaged in our country. And we need money. We need aid. And so, you know, essentially we will behave ourselves in order to get those things.
But it's got to occur to you that what's said in the breakfast room at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Doha might be different than what is said and what the transaction are in Kandahar, Kabul, Mazar-e-Sharif, and Herat.
Absolutely. The Taliban is not remotely monolithic, and it is riven by factions, all of which are struggling with each other, and some of which are more radical than others. And it's very hard to know even who's making the decisions right now, or, you know, who's on top. It's very, very difficult. We don't have a lot of visibility on any of that. And so things could change very rapidly overnight.
In looking at the tremendous amount of money that went into this effort, how could we have trained thousands of soldiers who then disappeared, melted away in the term of art lately? It's as if the entire Afghan government has been a mirage, and the Afghan government's military even more so.
You know, I remember back in 2001 when the war started, and the U.S. military didn't wipe out enormous Taliban formations. Most of the Taliban surrender came in the form of Taliban soldiers walking across the line and embracing their Afghan brethren in the Northern Alliance. And it exactly what we've witnessed over the past week. You just had people quitting and walking over to the other side. And I think, you know, at this point, Afghanistan has been at war for 42 years, and the instinct of the average typical Afghan soldier is to survive. And I think the moment he felt, man, the Americans are gone. I mean, practically speaking, that was a disaster for the Army. But I think it was like, why bother? I know which way the wind is blowing. So I'm done. I'm going home. It's not worth it to me.
Now, these are not revelations. It's not a new thing to even the most conservative neocon American consciousness, the difficulty of what you call the American project in Afghanistan. We know from official documents obtained by the Washington Post that as early as 2002, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld wrote in a memo that, quote, "We're never going to get the U.S. military out of Afghanistan," unquote. And he concluded this memo by simply writing the word "help!" exclamation point. How do you respond to that?
The most depressing thing to me is if you imagine the U.S. military and its diplomatic corps is kind of a great machine that is supposed to be kind of dynamic and alive and processing information and, you know, correcting course and changing course when it needs to. The thing could never change. It was clear, or if it were clear in 2002 or 2003, which it was, that the thing wasn't working. The machine never corrected itself. The American military and the State Department and the diplomatic corps, the overwhelming impression I got was that they're not listening. They don't understand the country. They don't understand what's happening. So they don't know how to change course, or if they do, they go the wrong way. And we don't know how to do this. We're just not good at this.
How many times are we going to do this? Whether it's the French in Algeria, the French in Indochina, the U.S. in Vietnam, the U.S. in Afghanistan. If the most senior people at the Pentagon from the war's earliest days are essentially saying, this is a quagmire, how does the machine just keep going for two decades? What is the dynamic from Republican to Democratic administration, regardless of party, how does it not get stopped and we end up where we are now?
I think what was so gallingly obvious was that everyone in the U.S. government knew exactly what we're talking about here. They knew that the Afghan government was predatory. They knew that it was a criminal state. They had a name for it. They called it VICE, V-I-C-E, which stood for Vertically Integrated Criminal Enterprise. That was the name that the Pentagon gave to the Afghan government. They knew. And yet, the thing did not get fixed. And so what was that? And I guess ultimately it was a lack of political will.
It seems interesting or ironic that one of the major American politicians who earlier would get up in meetings of in the Situation Room and say, we don't have a possibility of victory here, we should get out, is Joe Biden. The person on whom the burden of the withdrawal falls, and you can easily argue who's responsible for the titanic and tragic screw-up of the execution of that withdrawal. But if you look at Biden's voice in the arguments within the Obama administration, he's a voice telling Obama, don't listen to the generals, don't have a surge, get out. And now it lands on him. What has been Biden's role in this epic all along?
Well, I think you're right. I think Biden from the beginning was deeply skeptical of the United States attempting anything ambitious in Afghanistan. I think he did believe that President Obama got rolled by the generals, intimidated by the generals in 2009 when Obama did the surge. I think there are moments where Biden, and I think in this case he was confronted by Richard Holbrooke, the special envoy, who said, you know, we can't leave in a hurry. You understand that, Mr. Vice President, you know, back in 2009. 2010. And Vice President Biden essentially saying, out, get out, we're leaving. I don't care. I don't care about all the Afghans on the ground there. Don't bother me with this.
The I don't care is will leave a hideous taste in the mouth of history for a long time to come.
Yeah, here we are.
You know, a lot of people say that, you know, in the end, this will not hurt Joe Biden politically in places like Scranton, because people who bear the costs of this war, who have always borne the costs of this war, are in places like Scranton, and they're happy not to send their kids there anymore.
That's right. That's true. It's this war was fought, and the war in Iraq was fought by, you know, 19-year-olds. But I don't know anyone watching on television what has unfolded over the past week cannot be pleased with the way it was done, even if they believed strongly that we needed to leave. And I think that that's going to stick. The callousness and the unnecessary cruelty with which the withdrawal was done, I think that'll stick with virtually everyone. It just didn't have to happen this way.
Dexter Filkins, thank you so much. You can read Dexter's reporting on Afghanistan and much more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm in my kitchen, standing at the stove with a laptop on the counter. And meanwhile, as the pan heats up, I'm zooming into another kitchen in Connecticut, where Jacques Pepin is perched on a chair. He's 85 and looks 20 years younger. He came to prominence as a chef in the 1960s after years of cooking in regimented French kitchens. He cooked for Charles de Gaulle and other French leaders, and he was offered a job at the White House, too. But starting in the 1970s, Pepin willed a new career into being, teaching, publishing books, and broadcasting. He trained generations of chefs. And on television, first alongside Julia Child, he brought the gospel into many, many American homes. So it's a little unnerving, uncanny, looking at Jacques Pepin, because I've seen him so many times in this kitchen, but now he's looking back at me, and the expression in his hazel eyes is he's concerned because he's already sized up my skills at the stove. So I have to tell you, I'm nervous as hell. It's like getting basketball lessons from LeBron James. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you.
No, this is not brain surgery. It's all right.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I'm only halfway decent at scrambled eggs, at best halfway decent. But Pepin is going to walk me through something a little harder, making a crepe.
I've got eggs, I've got milk, I've got butter, I've got flour.
All right, so first, why don't you put a piece of butter to melt, like a couple of tablespoons, in the skillet that you are going to make the crepe in. Let's see the skillet. It's a non-stick skillet, right?
It's a non-stick skillet.
Okay, good.
And a tablespoon of butter?
Well, a good tablespoon and a half, I would say.
All right, heat's on.
I don't think you have the right amount here. Just the way I saw it at the end of the night.
All right, it's melting like it should.
All right.
All right.
Now put your flour in the bowl with the eggs, a dash of salt, pepper, and like half of the milk.
Okay, how much flour?
So you have half a cup of flour, I think.
How many eggs?
One egg.
Okay.
Well, good. A little dash of salt. And
any kind of salt? Kosher salt's okay?
Yeah, it's fine. And a bigger dash of sugar. 3/4 cup of milk. So just put about, measure your milk and put about half of it in the flour.
Just half of it?
Yes, just half of it.
All right. 3/4 cup of milk, voila. And just put half of it in the flour.
About, yes. Mix it with a whisk, right? Well, let's see that whisk. This is a mini whisk. Wow. It should come together very smooth.
Okay, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's smooth, yes, right. If you put all the milk, if you put all the milk to start with, then you have lump. So now you can put the rest of the milk in it.
Okay.
Is your butter melted?
Oh yes. In fact, you'll be glad to know it's burned.
Hold on. So anyway.
Let's do that again.
Yeah. Throw it out, right? You don't have to wash it.
I've not felt this much pressure in some time. Okay, more butter. All right. Okay. How high is the heat?
Very high. All right, now you can pour it in your batter.
Pour the butter in the batter.
Yeah. Stir it well.
With my pathetic whisk.
Now you're ready to make the crepe.
How much more butter do I put back in the pan?
You don't put any more butter, that's it.
That's it, okay.
Yeah. Okay, now you spread it out fast, move it. So that to spread it out fast, because otherwise it's going to take, okay. So now.
I spread out the batter, but the skillet isn't covered all the way, so I add in more batter to cover it, but then the first bit of batter starts to burn.
What happened is that as soon as that batter touched the pan, it solidified. So if you don't spread it fast, then it's solidified and it's thicker. So you have to spread it fast. Oh, you have to be more assertive. Grab it with your hand now.
Grab it with my hands, the crepe?
Okay, well, now it's telling us. So that one is for the dog, usually.
Okay, so after that humbling moment, I pour another measure of batter in the pan.
All right.
Now? Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Oh. All right.
It's a good long apprenticeship.
Looks good, though.
Comme ça?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you should do, with the batter that you have, you should have done 6 crepes. When I was an apprentice, I had 6 pans. Pouring it
six
in one,
your going
second
at once?
One. Yeah, 6 at the same time. So, you know, you really have to be synchronized. You flip one, you turn the other. You flip one, you turn the other. You pour the batter in the third pan and so forth.
So Jacques, what is your earliest memory of making crepes? I mean, this seems to be something that is one of the first things in your training, no? As an apprentice?
Not only that, way before that, during the war, we didn't have too much to eat. And my mother would do crepes with flour, basically flour and water. And sometimes we had a leftover bread. She would soak the bread, a piece of bread, and put it on top of that batter. And that thing would really stuff you up. Wasn't particularly good, but it would stuff you up. And she put some type of syrup on top of it. We didn't have much sugar. So she used big bits, you know, and she would cut it, cook it with water, and reduce that to do a syrup to replace the sugar. You know, so that probably first memory of crepe. Crepe have always been part of, part of my family, whether very inexpensive type of crepe or very elegant, done in restaurant in one way or the other. But I mean, the basic crepe is easy to do.
Jacques, tell me this. What was your first memory in the kitchen? You often, when you make a dish in your shows, in your videos over the years, you smile and you say, you know, my mother would be very proud of me. And it's a very touching moment. It's clearly something resonant with you. When did you start cooking?
Well, probably age 6, 7. My mother, I had 2 brothers, an older one, a younger one. And my mother had a restaurant from about the age 5, 6 that I was. So actually in France, I can count 12 restaurants, 12 of them owned and operated by women. My aunt, cousin, too. I was the first male to go into that business. My father was a cabinet maker by trade. But during the war, when we helped in the kitchen, whether to feed the chicken or to peel the potato or to help or in the cellar with my father. So from age 5, 6, yes, we were in the kitchen. Actually, I left home when I was 13, 1949. I left home to go into apprenticeship. I was 13 years old. And as I said, I had been in the kitchen for a while already. So, yes, that was part of it.
When people hear the word apprenticeship, I think they have no idea how difficult it is. What is it like?
Well, it was very structured. It was kind of formal. But, you know, that's the way it was. I mean, we work from 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 at night with a cut of 2 to 5 in the afternoon. And then we had the bed. We slept upstairs. Now we work 7 days a week because at the end of the month, I had 4 days off, 1 day per week, even though there is more than 4 weeks in a month. So at that point, I would take the bus to go back to my house, to go back to my mother, because we live about 45 miles from Lyon to. Taking the towel, I had 3 towels, my jacket, pants, the sheet of my bed, all of that to bring that to my mother to wash and bring it back, because they didn't do that for you. In addition to that, we were not paid. I wasn't paid for 2 years. The third year, I started getting a little bit of money. Third year of apprenticeship, you know. But I mean, I don't want to make it sound that it was horrible. We were very happy. You know, I had 3 or 4 apprentices. We had a ball. We, you know, that's the way life was. So you cannot look at it in the context of now. You know, it's another world.
And you came to America, and you came on the scene, and along with Julia Child, introduced French cooking to Americans. How have you seen the food scene change over the years? It's got to be radical.
It would take an hour to talk about that. Yeah, I mean, I came here in 1959. I remember going to I live on 50th between 1st, 2nd Avenue in New York. And there was a little supermarket next door. I forget the name of it. Anyway, it was my first supermarket. And I thought it was great to have everything under the same roof. In France, I had to go to the fishmonger, then the meat and the vegetable, all different store. I thought it was great, but in the market, there was a lot of package. There was only one salad that was iceberg. There was no shallot, no leek. And I remember say, where are the mushrooms? They say, aisle 5. That was canned mushroom. There's no way you had any fresh mushroom. You get to a specialty store. So the supermarkets have never been as beautiful as they are today. So, but this is another world. It's totally, totally different. Yeah.
What changed everything? What do you think was the moment when the whole food scene changed?
Many, many things. I mean, certainly women liberation in the 60s, organic gardening, women liberation. After the war, American GI and all that, going back to Europe in vacation, going back to Italy, France, looking for food. All of that changed, you know, the plane itself. I mean, for me, the first time I came on a student boat, first time I took a plane was, I was going at Columbia University at the time. So they had a charter plane. First time I went back to France, and it was still the propeller and all that. That was 1963, 2, 4, whatever. And at that time, the people were starting going to Europe with those charter, and, you know, you get exposed to food, to market there, you come back. And, you know, all of that was the beginning of big change in America. But certainly the food now, I don't think there is any place in the world where you have the type of variety, you know, because of the ethnicity that we have in America, like 24,000 restaurants in New York. I mean, this is unmatched anywhere in the world, the type. In fact, when I came to America, I worked at the Pavillon. All the great restaurants were French restaurants, or so-called French restaurants, continental restaurants, where most of the stuff totally misspelled, but anyway. There was no great Chinese restaurant, no great Chinese restaurant, no great Italian restaurant, no great Japanese restaurant. Supposedly, all the great fancy restaurants were French. And look at it now, you know, there is some French restaurant now. I mean, Daniel, the Percé, but there is extraordinary from Chinese to Japanese to Thai to and so forth. So the thing has changed incredibly. You know? There was no wine when I came to this country. There was no great bread, wine, cheese, charcuterie. You know, that type of thing did not exist. It's very, very different.
What role did Julia Child play in that revolution?
Well, she did. I mean, I met Julia in 1960. So it was before she did any television, before she had any book. In fact, I met her because when I came to the U.S., I worked at the Pavilion, and then I met Craig Claiborne, who started at the New York Times, at the Food Critic, with Pierre Frenet, who was the executive chef at the Pavilion. He introduced me to Helen McCauley. Helen McCauley was the food editor of McCall, House Beautiful. So she kind of became my surrogate mother. I mean, you know, don't do this, do that, do whatever. She lived next to me in New York. And one day she said, oh, I have a manuscript. I want you to look at that. It was a manuscript of Mastering the Art of French Cooking that the editor sent to different people to review. And she said, the woman live in Boston. She's coming next week here. Do you want to cook? And I said, yeah, absolutely. That was Julia. She said, you know, she's a very tall woman with a terrible voice. Okay, I said, okay. And I remember that... I met Julia in 1960, and we mostly spoke French because she had just spent over 2 years in France. Her French was better than the English at the time. So that's how I met her. And then eventually she started doing her show in 64, I believe, 63 or 4. And Mastering the Art of French Cooking came a couple of years later. No, she was very influential in the sense that she was very natural. She was very... matter of fact, you know, and PBS, I have done show for PBS for 35 years, and, you know, I love PBS, so, yeah.
Now, a lot of the shows on television are no longer just what used to be called stand and stir.
Oh, yeah.
They're competitions. They're yes. Game shows, in a sense, with food. Absolutely, you like those?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't even watch my show, so I don't really watch cooking show on television. So,
what has cooking been like for you and your family during the pandemic?
Well, frankly, I have done over 200 shows of the Facebook show that I do during the pandemic. So it has been quite rewarding in many ways. But for me, I have many friends here, and cooking is always associated with being together with friends. It's a lifestyle. You know, when my daughter was 2 years old, a year and a half, 2 years, I hold her in my arm, and I'm doing something, and I say, okay, mélange, so mix it. So she would mix it, so she, quote, made it, because she was going to eat it, she made it. Yeah. So my granddaughter, I have a stool next to me, not now, she's taller than me, but when she was 4, 5, 6 years old, I said, okay, give me a bowl, give me that. Okay, give me the salad. You think that's where the salad is clean? Do you want to wash it? Let's wash the salad. Okay, so she goes. Then I take her to the garden. I say, get some parsley. She said, no, that's not parsley. That's chive. Taste it. She tastes that parsley. That's chive. Then I take her to the market. I say, okay, I need pear. Make sure they are ripe, or tomato. You think those tomatoes are ripe? Did you smell them? Did you touch them? So you come back. That's the whole canvas of communication that I have with the kid, you know, and that brings some other conversation. And more importantly, not the cooking together, but the sitting down and the enjoying of the food together. You know, there is no place like the table. The table is a great equalizer for everybody around the table, you know, especially in our time of polarization, you know, so.
Jacques, I've heard you say that, you know, you're often asked things like, what's your favorite food? You say you can't beat good bread and butter.
Oh, yes.
But is there a, thankfully, you know, nobody's sentencing you to the gallows, but what would be your last meal? What is the thing that you would want to
have
know
a
that
banana,
you had a taste
that,
of?
Well, I'm going to have from caviar to champagne to hot dog to ham and egg to squab. I mean, the most important thing is that it's going to be very, 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 very long. Maybe a few months.
That's a good meal. Jacques, thank you so much, and you be well.
All right.
All the very,
okay. Thank
all
you
the very,
very
best.
Much. Have a great day. Happy cooking. Okay.
Jacques Pepin, the author of dozens of cookbooks, most recently Jacques Pepin Quick and Simple, which came out last year. Now, a cookbook that a lot of foodies have been talking about during the pandemic is called Cooking Solo. It's by the food writer Clancy Miller. Miller trained as a pastry chef in Paris, and she recently launched a new magazine called For the Culture, which is all about Black women in the food and wine field. One of her big fans is our staff writer, Helen Rosner.
I am so excited to talk with Clancy Miller, the writer and editor and cookbook author whose 2016 book, Cooking Solo, The Joy of Cooking for Yourself, is one of those books that, for me, changed the way that I cook. It changed the way that I think about cooking as an act of care, not just to other people, but to myself. It was a real philosophical awakening. And over the last year and a half, it's been especially apt as the world has moved through various lockdowns, restaurant closures, reopenings, grocery availabilities and scarcities. I think the way that everybody has cooked has changed a little bit. And Clancy's book has been one of my guideposts. It's been a hell of a summer.
It has been. It started off so nicely, and now it's just like, haha, the world is ending. It's not. it's not, but this is a heavy, heavy week.
A lot of the lessons in the book, both on a sort of practical culinary basis, but also the bigger philosophy that you express, this idea that joy does not have to be shared, right? Joy can be just you and, you know, your beautiful piece of fish or your beautiful salad or whatever it is, has felt very urgent, I think. I know for so many people who spent time alone in over the last year and a half, it feels like a really important philosophy to hold on to.
I think so, yes. It's something that I have believed for a really long time, that you as a person are just as worthy of a generous gesture or a delicious meal as a loved one or anyone you would invite into your home. And I do not think that is a laborious exercise. I think it really can be joyful. I think it can be creative. It can also be very simple. It doesn't have to be an elaborate, you know, feast. But yeah, this summer, first of all, it's been random. The weather, it's like heat wave raining. So I generally don't feel like cooking a lot. I make salads a lot. I make like fattoush is my inspirational thing right now.
I love making fattoush. That's one of my favorites, the classic Middle Eastern salad with crispy pita bread. And how do you make your dressing? I use lots of lime juice and dried mint.
So I've been playing around with different dressings. I sometimes will do just like a lemon garlic olive oil situation, and I'll add sumac. If I feel like I'm working with extremely flavorful ingredients, I'll just kind of salt it and do lemon juice. One of the things I enjoyed about making Cooking Solo was figuring out how can you do desserts for one. So I don't know, you can saute some fruit and have like a scoop of ice cream, or you know what I mean? Like you can poach some pears.
I live with my husband. I rarely cook just for myself, but when I do, it is interesting to have to build up that activation energy to actually put the effort in just for me. And it feels really, I don't want to say indulgent, because I think that's sort of contrary to what you have been trying to express in your book and in your work since then. It's not an indulgence. It's just a simple act of care. But it's this degree of effort that, you know, there's like a bit of a hurdle where it's like, well, you know, slice the apple a little bit nicely. Put it on a real plate. Don't just eat it out of a Ziploc bag or whatever it might be. It feels a little bit more special, which when the world feels like it's falling apart is a sort of gentle corrective.
Yeah, I should also say that this book came from a very specific place for me. The kernel for the book came from when I was in culinary school, studying pastry in Paris, and kind of using the city as my homework or my larger classroom. And so everything was really fun for me in terms of A, it was my first time living alone. B, I had never been to culinary school. C, I was encouraged to actually go out and look at food and just like be with food in many different ways. So for me, in that that was my first time cooking for myself, it every day felt like an adventure. I think one of the reasons why like I see it as a joyful act is because when I first started cooking for myself, it truly was a joyful act.
I'd love to kind of sort of set the scene of, so you've made your salad, you've made your beautiful piece of fish. Mm-hmm. What about the act of dining alone? Because cooking alone is one thing, and I think you can keep yourself occupied, you know, by doing the actual work of cooking, but then you have to sit down and eat. And it's just you. So how do you dine alone? Does that get wrapped in ritual or flowers on the table, or how does that work?
I do love flowers on a table. I love getting bouquets of flowers. I also am a huge fan of candelabras. I collect them. So I like a pretty table. I'm working on a book right now, so sometimes my table gets overloaded with junk, but I like to properly clear it off, sit down, relax. Sometimes I will watch television, I won't lie, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
We're only human. Clancy, thank you so much for giving us this time today and for being so flexible. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. This is a nice thing to look forward to that's not work.
It's technically work. It's just the fun kind.
Helen Rosner talking with Clancy Miller, author of Cooking Solo. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. And before we go, let's have a little fun. We launched a new quiz recently at newyorker.com, and it comes out every weekday morning. It's kind of addictive, and I promise it won't do anything bad to you. So our puzzles and games editor, Liz Maines Amanzade, is here to describe the New Yorker's name drop. So Liz, how do you play?
The goal of name drop is to guess the identity of a notable person using as few clues as possible. If you guess correctly after just one clue, you'll score a 6. And if you guess after two clues, you'll score a 5, and so on. And the clues get easier as you go.
So you can do this alone, online, but I wanted a friend to do this with, so I've got a little competition now. Staff writer Nomi Fry is here. Nomi, you ready to play?
David, I was born ready.
I feel like I'm dead in the water here.
No.
All right. Liz, you got a starter pistol or something?
I don't. Maybe they can edit in an air horn or something.
Okay, and the idea is you're going to read out all the clues and we're not going to bark an answer along the way?
That's right. So that way people who are listening can play through the full quiz.
All right, fair enough.
But we should say, I got it, but we then remain silent.
All right, let's play name drop.
All right, round one. This is for 6 points. When I was a teenager, I played Cleo Hewitt on season 4 of the TV show Fame.
All right, this is, Nomi's going to get this one faster. Go ahead, keep going. TV
well,
critic.
I don't have it yet.
Yeah.
Okay, for 5 points. We are a nation with no geographic boundaries, bound together through our beliefs. I intone these words at the beginning of my 4th studio album, released in 1989.
Oh, I got it. Ugh.
David?
I'm not there yet.
Okay, for 4. I sat next to my frequent collaborators, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, at a ceremony honoring me as an MTV icon. Aaliyah, a presenter, remarked that my name was synonymous with great dancing.
Okay.
After the presidential debate in which Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman, Spotify streams of a song from my 1986 album Control rose by 250%.
Okay, I'm so tempted to use Google at this point, but I really feel that's wrong.
All right, for two. I'm the youngest of 10 children in an accomplished family of musicians. I severed professional ties with my father, Joe, who had been my manager, after my second album, Dream Street.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and the final clue.
I think I know.
My 10 number one singles include Miss You Much, That's the Way Love Goes, Together Again, and All for You.
Is this Miley Cyrus, maybe? No.
Ooh. Nomi, what'd you get?
It's Janet Jackson.
That's right.
It's Janet Jackson?
It's Janet Jackson.
Oh, God.
I did not remember she was on season 4 of Fame. I have to admit.
I have never seen that show. Did you watch it, Nomi?
I watched it. I think you're too young, Liz. I watched it when this was, I think it was like 1983, maybe.
This is my problem. I'm too young, too. I don't remember any of this.
That's right. You have another round to catch up. Should we do it?
More boomer questions, please.
This one is maybe less generationally biased. Okay. This is round 2 for 6 points. I once said that my favorite place to work was the back of my Model A Ford, which I'd converted into a mobile studio.
Nope.
No.
All right, for 5. I occupy the final place setting in The Dinner Party, the installation by Judy Chicago, who described my work as pivotal in the development of an authentically female iconography.
Oh. Ugh, I feel like I should know this.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, no.
My early work was exhibited by the photographer Alfred Stieglitz, whom I later married, and who took hundreds of photographic portraits of me.
Oh, now I know this.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're both writing it down for 4. All right, for 3. From the 1930s until shortly before my death in 1986, I spent many of my summers on a property known as the Ghost Ranch near the village of Abiquiu, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Clue 2, my painting Jimson Weed White Flower Number 1 sold for more than $44 million in 2014, making it the most expensive painting by a female artist. And the final clue, my namesake museum in Santa Fe has in its collection many of my modernist paintings of oversized flowers, animal skulls, and southwestern landscapes.
Is it Georgia O'Keeffe?
It's Georgia O'Keeffe.
It is Georgia O'Keeffe. And you both got that one, I think, on the third clue?
Well, who's counting? Who's really counting, Liz? it's really not winning and losing. It's winning and losing, isn't it? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you've changed your tune a little, David.
Nevertheless, Nomi, Liz, thank you. You're both fired. And I appreciate it. Next time, come with some easier ones. It's really a fun game. And Liz, thank you for you and your colleagues for inventing it. It's great fun. And it's up every day, every weekday at newyorker.com. Liz, Nomi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can play at newyorker.com/namedrop. And you can play Name Drop with us on the air. Liz and I will read you the clues and we'll see how you do. There might even be a prize in there somewhere. So write us at newyorkerradio@wnyc.org and just make your subject line Name Drop and give us a phone number where we can reach you. Again, newyorkerradio@wnyc.org. Hope to talk with you soon.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.